starts glowing, and the film starts rolling. You wanna be knowing what you might be in for. So give the show a listen. If you know what you're missing, put yourself in position. What the if it gets your
top of the morning to you, everyone, out in listener land. This is Brian, here with The Goods, a film podcast, and Dan.
I was going to open with top of the morning to you, Brian, so we were on the same wavelength there.
Yeah, both our mornings have been topped. So as always, Dan, we've watched a movie this week. And as I like to do, as I think we both like to do, it's tied to the calendar, but as of when we record, not necessarily when the episode rolls out, but we generally keep it pretty close. A couple days ago, it was St. Patrick's Day. You may have seen the Shamrock Shake advertisements in the window of your local McDonald's.
Considering I work from home full time, I don't really leave my house that often. So I have not seen a single Shamrock Shake ad, I have to say.
Wow. You uncultured swine, in the words of Mr. Potato Head. No, I drive around a lot. I was driving around a lot today. And I did get a few Shamrock Shakes in this season.
Gotta pound them while you can.
Attentive listeners may remember that last year we watched a St. Patrick's Day tied film. Also from Disney, actually. It was The Luck of the Irish we talked about. And so this year I went with another St. Patrick's Day film, which really just means it involves Ireland and leprechauns in both cases.
You know, that's a good point. This actually has nothing to do with St. Patrick's Day.
Well, he is the patron saint, like, of the country, so I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that something related to the nation of Ireland is completely removed from St. Patrick's Day.
We'll get into it, but are little people explicitly leprechauns in this? They got pots of gold. But do they ever use the term leprechaun?
I think he does say leprechaun.
Yeah, I think so too. I think I remember him saying that.
And this is a movie that I've been watching since I was five. So like The Court Jester, it's pretty in my brain. There was also a promotional episode of the 1950s Disneyland TV show hosted by Walt Disney that was called I Captured the King of the Leprechauns. So it's not a case where it's like you never say zombies in Night of the Living Dead. Once, at least once or twice, they say leprechauns. And yes, this, if we didn't name drop the title, it's Darby O'Gill and the Little People from 1959, directed by Robert Stevenson. So last week, we talked about the history of Disney's animated films. And round about, I think, 1950 is when it started, they dipped their toes into live action as well. Their future and their fortune with animation seemed maybe uncertain at that point, and so they went the more the traditional Hollywood route and started putting out these live action films, beginning with Treasure Island in 1950. And that turned out to be successful too, and so to this day, Disney is still making both kinds of films. But Robert Stevenson cranked out a lot of these 1950s and 60s live-action films, including some pretty high-profile ones. I mean, he did Mary Poppins. Spoilers. That's like the big mind-blower. But also Bedknobs and Broomsticks, also the Flubber movies, also Old Yeller, the Love Bug movies. And the Gnome-mobile, which I called out a couple weeks ago, which was kind of the spiritual follow-up to Darby O'Gill.
Who can forget Herbie Rides Again? He actually got a Best Director nomination for Mary Poppins, so there's some Academy pedigree in this.
I think Mary Poppins won an Oscar. Was that Best Actress for Andrews?
Yep.
Okay.
I believe that's the only Oscar it won.
Dan, what was your familiarity with Darby O'Gill prior to this week?
So at some point since we started the podcast, I tried to watch it with my daughters, and it was not a case where they were disinterested in it, although they weren't super hooked by it. It's a little slow, we'll talk about, but for whatever reason, we didn't finish it. And so I had seen like the first 15 or 20 minutes, but never the rest of it. But I knew that it was one that was important to you.
That's right. It's been part of my life for a long time. My mom showed it to me when I was very little. And well, think in the big scheme of things, how many movies each holiday gets. And Christmas gets a bumper crop. Just endless Christmas movies. We talked about Hallmark and how they're putting out like 15 movies a season or something.
Halloween, not far behind.
And Halloween, of course, is no slouch because they get the whole genre of horror. Doesn't even have to be tied to a time of year. They just get every horror movie. Other holidays are slouching. They don't make up the ground.
In 2021, I tried to find every Thanksgiving-related movie that I could and watch them all Thanksgiving week. And it is thin pickings, I gotta say.
But at least now we have one featuring one Milo Manheim.
Yeah, and that one was pretty good. I did catch up with that one. I mean, it's a slasher, but it's a pretty good slasher.
And yeah, St. Patrick's Day. When you ask people, what movie do you watch on St. Patrick's Day? A common answer is The Quiet Man with John Wayne. I did watch that one a couple years ago.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that was St. Patrick's themed.
Well, it's Ireland. He's after an Irish girl, and her name is, what's the actress in that? Somebody famous.
I don't know. I haven't seen The Quiet Man.
Maureen O'Hara.
But that's actually not the only connection with today's film between The Quiet Man and Darby O'Gill and The Little People, because they actually share a cinematographer. Winton C. Hawk, who was a prolific cinematographer in the 40s, 50s, 60s, I think. He was the cinematographer for this, as well as some John Ford movies, including Quiet Man and The Searchers. And I would say you can tell this movie is made by a good cinematographer. It's very attractive.
Yeah. There's some talent at work in this movie. And Walt Disney really wanted to sell the visually convincing nature of this film, because the title tells you what we're expecting, which is little people or leprechauns. And in the opening credits, there's this little thank you note to King Brian of Knocknashiga and his leprechauns. Like, they're real, guys. Also, the lead leprechaun is named Brian, so maybe that's why it's stuck in my memory as much as it has.
Some people get really attached to characters that have the same name as them. We've had Gavin on the podcast. He's got very strong Gavin character opinions. He either loves them or he's very mad at them for besmirching the name Gavin if they're not a good Gavin.
For me, I have it out against Y Brian's.
Oh, you okay, right, because you're an I Brian.
That's right. It's like a tribal war.
Interesting. I did read that Walt Disney, you know, at this point in his career, he had the whole empire, and he was obviously famously very obsessed with crafting his theme parks. So he was kind of touch and go on how involved he was in the actual production of a film. But this was one that he had extra special hand in, I think. He was excited about this project. And I think that kind of shows on the production values and the polish.
I watched the Disneyland episode that ties into this, which was on the DVD that I have. And yeah, Disney himself is very involved, like talking to the actors. It's interesting that you do like a TV special that's all about a movie and includes clips from the movie and basically tells the whole movie.
It's like, why not?
Like, I mean, it seems like you're kind of giving away the whole thing. But maybe back in that day, you know, there was no home video. It's like, maybe you catch this TV episode and maybe it catches your interest, but there's no TiVo. And, like, you can't look it up on the internet, so maybe. You know, maybe it's not as jarring as we would think today.
Well, what is our podcast but a discussion of the whole movie, Brian?
Right. Well, plus it's in black and white. The TV episode was in black and white. So then you got to go see it in color, right?
Oh, I did. I saw a screen cap of something in black and white and I was surprised because I was like, the movie is in beautiful Technicolor. But that explains it. There you go.
And I can kind of see why maybe your young kids wouldn't latch on to the story, because it's like very adult focused. All the characters are adults, which doesn't necessarily make it inaccessible to children. But I think if there's a draw to kids, it's just that there are leprechauns in it and that the music is, you know, there's music, there's fantasy.
Right. There is. Yeah, there's some appeal to it. But I mean, it's basically the story of a town drunk losing his job and hallucinating mythical creatures. Potentially.
Yes, we'll talk about that.
Now, maybe not a kid friendly plot, to your point.
No, this is one that I just came in the door before we recorded, basically, so it may be a little off the cuff. But I was definitely thinking about that reading of it this time, that I think I like stories where you've got an older protagonist who has this, like, spiritual life on the fringes of society that may or may not be real, and yet it is still, like, a meaningful narrative. So I'm thinking Christmas Carol. Where you got these ghosts intervening in your life, but are they really, or are you just dreaming because you ate bad gruel?
Right. More gravy than grave about you.
Yeah, but it evokes and brings about real world results.
You haven't by chance seen the Denis Villeneuve, or however you say his name, the guy who made the Dune movies, his movie Enemy?
No. What's that about?
It's very interesting. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal, and the premise is that he discovers basically a clone of himself living a different life. And the entire movie is basically constructed to make you wonder if this is a Tyler Durden situation, or to what extent this is a Tyler Durden situation. And so I was actually thinking about the whole hallucinating aspect a lot as I was watching this, because I just watched Enemy last night.
Yeah, we'll come back to that idea, because I have over the years come down firmly on one side or the other. But one other movie I would say falls into the category of you've got these, like, meta-human characters involved, like, not quite existing on the same plane of reality as people, and are they quote-unquote real, and does that matter to the ultimate outcome of the story? Another film that I would lump in there is Inside Out. Are the emotions beings? Like, does it matter if they are real conscious entities or not? Or are they just an expression of what's going on?
That's interesting. And I've always liked that reading to some extent for the Toy Stories as well. Now, those ones have a few more physical things that you can tie to, but this idea that, you know, even if you just take the very cowboy versus spaceman dilemma, it's like a dilemma of childhood nostalgia versus looking into the future. And obviously that gets more metaphoric as you get into the later ones, more about growing up and letting go childhood and all that. I might choose the Toy Stories for my birthday pick this year. I haven't locked in on it, but that's one thing I'm thinking about.
It would give you an excuse to come over and we'll watch the 3D Blu-rays that you gave me of the Toy Story trilogy.
Oh, yeah, that's right. What I really want to see is Day and Night, which was the short that they released in 3D, but I don't know if that's on the Blu-ray I got you.
I feel like it must be, but it's been sitting on the shelf. Got to open it up. But as you said, this movie follows an older gentleman living in an Irish village. His name is Darby O'Gill, and he works as a caretaker on the grounds of this lord's estate. So this is sometime in the 1800s. They make reference to the potato famine having happened. So that was in like the 1840s. So I guess this is mid to late 1800s, but there's not really any technology around that you see. So it's vintage. Also, this is not really Ireland that we're looking at. It was filmed in, like, the grassy hills of California. And when we see like very wide shots, the grass looks pretty yellowish in some in some scenes.
There's also a tremendous amount of set work here too, I think. Like some terrific matte paintings, like strongly evoking beautiful Irish vistas.
Yes. Yeah. I'm speaking too critically of it because I actually really like the way this movie looks. Lots of matte paintings. And so Darby lives in the groundskeeper's house on this estate where it's owned by a lord, but the lord is out and about a lot. Like he'll go to the city. And so this is like his summer house or his vacation house where this nobleman will come sometimes, but he's not there a lot. And up on the grounds of this large house, there's what Darby refers to as a fairy mountain, which is this hill that's got like stone ruins on it. And I really like this idea of just that you can be an old man and what do you have in your life? Oh, well, you go and you hang out on the fairy mountain in your backyard that just happens to be back there. It's like being able to find wonder wherever you happen to be has always appealed to me.
Perhaps chemically assisted.
Maybe so. Because he does spend all his time in the pub. Which, if Banshees of Inisherin is to be believed, is a common pastime among Irishmen. Like, that's what you do at a certain time of day is you go over to the pub.
I gotta watch more Martin McDonagh movies, because there's just such an Irish flavor to that one. And he does not seem eager to refute Irish stereotypes, and nor does this film. Lots of emphasis on alcohol.
Precisely. I got to track down some Pachin.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that.
We'll get there. So one day, as fate would have it, the Lord comes back, and Darby is not there. He's out drinking in the pub. And Darby has an adult daughter named Katie, who lives with him in his groundskeeper's cottage. And she goes into town to bring him back from the pub. But what he does at the pub, in addition perhaps to imbibing, is he likes to regale the patrons with his stories interacting with the leprechauns. So Darby O'Gill has met the king of the leprechauns, whose name is King Brian. And the way that leprechauns work in this movie is like genies. If you catch one, they have to grant you three wishes. But as often is the case with wish granters, we get quibbles, right? Like we talked about with Bedazzled, that they're always looking for an out, a way to not quite grant your wish the right way. So there's this flashback where we see the leprechaun for the first time, where Darby O'Gill is telling the story of the time he almost got the pot of gold out of King Brian. And in this case, King Brian tricks him into making more than three wishes. And if you make a fourth wish, then you lose them all. And he vanishes into the night and the pot of gold disapparates.
I thought this was pretty funny. I like this.
The energy between these two guys is so good.
Yeah.
I love the comic repartee between these two old Irish guys.
And one thing I want to call out here, we definitely need to talk a little bit about some of the visual tricks this movie uses with regards to the leprechauns. But I like that we basically see this scene play out and we see the pot of gold and the jewels that he's sitting on and all that and him having a conversation with a little person. And it's all practical. I mean, it's possible. Brian and I were talking out of band that there's some stuff that like matting that I don't know if you still call that practical, if you did it in the pre-digital days, maybe still, but like the amount of stuff that they're able to accomplish just with production design and camera tricks is really phenomenal. And just it's a they don't make them like they used to movie in so many ways. And that's my favorite thing about it. They don't make them like they used to. It's got like incredible lighting and production design and stuff that if this were made in 2024, it would just be cheap CGI. It honestly would probably just be like an Illumination CGI movie or something if they tried to make this today, you know?
Right. Because we have leprechauns and they're about a foot high. That's the way they're presented. But they used real human actors to do it. And at least according to the making of documentaries, it's all through the use of forced perspective, where you got the little person standing farther away from the camera than the big person. But they got really clever with it. Like, there's a lot of shots where they make the leprechaun look like they're the person who's closer to the camera than the big person in the background.
Right. So there's so many things. It's not just, oh, this guy's close to the camera, this guy's far away. Because there's much more than meets the eye to it. You have to be extremely careful with the lighting because shadows could give the game away. And like, oh, this guy's really bright, but this guy's not quite so bright. That is like a clue to your eye that you're looking at things at different depths. You can't have that.
Yes. And the focus also has to be the same on both of them, which to have basically an infinite depth of focus where somebody really far away is just as clear as somebody in the foreground, you have to have a very narrow aperture. And to have a very narrow aperture, that makes everything dark. So it's like you have to have a ton of light. And in this little making of that was on the DVD, it said they used just so many lights that everybody was really hot.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, they do look a little sweaty, which fits old man vibe to some extent. But I was wondering, I've been, you know, as I watch movies, I try to learn a little bit more about the technology and all that. The concept of a split diopter, which is basically where you have two focuses within one lens, and or I guess two depths of field on like a lens. And usually the giveaway on that is there's like a distinct blurry edge, which I did not notice here. But I'm wondering if they had to like design lenses specifically to capture like the different sizes of things, but make it all look like it was in a similar focus and stuff.
Oh, you know, yesterday I watched a movie with a diopter. It was a documentary shot in Antarctica that did all kinds of crazy camera tricks and just innovative stylistic things. Like there was a lot of snow falling backwards and waves crashing backwards and icicles dripping upside down.
Wow.
So the name of it was Antarctica Calling. At least that was the English title, but it was by a French director. I think the French title was just To the South Pole or something, Journey to the South Pole.
Okay.
But I'm going to give it 5 stars on Letterboxd. I haven't yet, but the visuals were that impressive.
That's awesome.
Just one guy walking around Antarctica seemingly by himself. I mean, he's got a crew, I guess, of like 3 or 5 people, but it's just this huge arid, empty, white expanse.
I already mentioned Denis Villeneuve or whatever. His very first movie is called August 32nd on Earth. And it's sort of like a rom-com, kind of in the vein of like a Before Sunrise or Singles, or maybe like Breathless from like the French New Wave or whatever. There's just two characters kind of walking around and talking. But it's shot like in a surreal way. And the really surreal thing is like half the movie takes place in the Bonneville Salt Flats in Utah. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of them. It's like just this flat white expanse. And it's so strange looking on film.
Wow. I've actually been to the Bonneville Salt Flats.
Oh, really?
And it is striking. That's where they go and they race the rocket cars. They do all the, everybody sets their land speed records in Bonneville Salt Flats.
Interesting.
But Katie fetches Darby from the pub and brings him to the estate, back to the house, where the Lord is waiting. And I like the various excuses that Darby tries to make. He's like always saying, oh, I'm just about to get to work. And the Lord says, no, you're not. You're done. We're done professionally. Because he's brought Sean Connery in like his first, not quite leading, like he's not the lead here, but it's a prominent Hollywood feature role, to be the replacement, be the new blood to take over as the caretaker. And honestly, this deal is not so bad. He says he's going to give Darby like a pension and put him in some other smaller house somewhere on the estate. It doesn't really seem like their lives are going to change that much.
Would that America took care of their retiring old drunks so well. Yeah, so two related questions, Brian. One, Sean Connery, at age, I don't know, he's probably like, what, 25 or 27 or something here. I didn't look it up. Handsomest actor we've ever had on the goods.
Oh, well, we don't usually go specifically for that, but yeah, I mean, he looks like a movie star. One thing is that he has straight teeth, and almost nobody else in this Irish village does. We got some really gnarly dental work on display in this film. It's like Sean Connery and the leading lady are the ones with nice full sets of choppers.
And then my second related question, most attractive top three leads, or I guess you could say cast in general, of any of our movies, because you got Janet Munro is the name of the actress who plays Katie O'Gill, and she's very classic movie star beautiful. And then we're going to get to this kind of antagonist foil type guy here, and he's also, he's got maybe a little bit of a snotty look to him, but he's definitely a charmer as well.
I'm glad that you see something in Pony Sugru, because I do want to talk about Pony Sugru. The very first thing, before any leprechauns, anything else, the first character who shows up is this old lady who is the widow Sugru, and she barges into Darby's house and is trying to get Katie's ear, talking up her son, saying, "Oh, you should marry my son." And she's this creep. And she looks like the witches in Ocarina of Time. I don't know. She's just got these big bulging eyes. Like, or like, who's the witch in Spirited Away?
Oh, she does look like her. You're right. Yeah.
Yubaba or something.
Right. Oh my gosh. You're right. Now that I'm thinking about it, that's like exactly, it's like a human rendering of that.
By the way, listeners, there are different audio tracks of this movie. At some point after the theatrical release, I think maybe for like the VHS release, they did this weird dub where they dubbed over the characters perceived to have too strong of Irish accents. And it's mostly the old people. So like Widow Sugru and Darby and the King all got dubbed over. I believe that Sean Connery and Janet Munro stayed the same. But also anywhere in the movie that somebody spoke Gaelic, they dubbed it over with English. So very strange. So just make sure that you find the one, like if they, I guess if they sound too normal, you found the wrong one.
I watched a rip of the Blu-ray, which was a terrific transfer, looked really great. And also I was able to get subtitles, which I would need because it is very hard to understand what they're saying at times because they're speaking in that thick Irish accent.
I'm trying to think what's one of the first things that Widow Sugru says. She says she stopped by for a pinch of tea.
Yeah. I was like, wait, did you really just say pinch of tea? It sounded like generic Irish noises that came out of your mouth. Like it wasn't words.
But yeah, her son that she's always lobbying for, but also like pushing around, is this guy named Pony Sugru, who is essentially Gaston. He's the big brute in the town who is after the affections of Katie O'Gill, but she's not really giving him the time of day. But also, it's a small town and there's a small pool of applicants. Until Sean Connery gets brought in on a wagon.
Kind of talk about a dream scenario. Oh man, I'm a single young woman. Oh, here comes young Sean Connery in on a wagon.
Unattached.
Offering to take care of my dad. Gainfully employed.
Right, and it's even better because Darby doesn't tell her that Michael, Sean Connery, is there to take his job. He just says, here's a handsome young man who's here to help around the garden. Not that he's a usurper. And so, yeah, Janet Munro and Sean Connery pretty soon are flirting. But Darby has his whole side life going on where he interacts with the fairy world. And he goes up to the top of Nakhnashiga. That's the name of the fairy hill. And I love to say Nakhnashiga. And Nakhnashiga is a matte painting. So it's like you can walk toward it, but you can't ever really get up there. I think they have another framing of it where it's like he is there, but it has a different matte painting. But I like the look of that, the ruins up on the hill.
It is kind of funny because they have the matte painting. And then there's like once or twice where they need to show a character on a hill. Like I'm thinking later in the movie. And then you're right. It's just like it's not this gorgeous, picturesque hill that we've seen in the matte painting. It's just like a hill in California, you know, like some grass.
And Darby, while he's up on the mountain, he's chasing after his horse. And there's some discussion throughout the movie of, is it really a horse or is it a puka, which is a like a Irish horse spirit that's like leading them astray, manipulating their paths. And while he's following this horse around, he falls down a well. And I like the shot of most of the effects in this movie look really good. Some are a little off-putting. But when he goes down the well and it's like his image is spiraling around and shrinking down, I like the kookiness of that effect.
Right.
He's like, oh!
And this is some, definitely some matting. There's some very basic, like, weird, I don't even know how they did it. There's a lot in here I don't know how they did. But, like, when you see the supernatural, it's almost like, it made me think of the old double exposure stuff. But it's, like, more surreal than that. They, like, kind of flicker and glow. Like, it's a negative exposure or something. I don't know exactly what's going on.
Yeah, a few of the characters, especially later on, but when the horse does ghosty things, it has this filter on it. I think it's solarization that we saw in the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
Where it's like there, it's kind of like green screen. It's like parts of them are replaced with color.
Right.
Like patches of color. And that doesn't hold up quite as well as the forced perspective stuff, but it's interesting. And down in the heart of the mountain, Darby is taken in for an audience with the king by a whole bunch of leprechauns. Like, they just go nuts here. It's like 100 leprechauns in this leprechaun throne room where they have all these treasures that they've collected over the centuries. So not only are they like genies, they're also like dragons. But I guess you expect leprechauns to have a bunch of gold. If you expect anything of leprechauns, it's that.
I was thinking a little bit of like Oz, because it's this kind of fancy place where munchkins live, and it's like some other, it's almost like another universe when he falls in the well. Not exactly clear how real it is or how not real it is, kind of like Oz. But I really like the treasures that they have in here. There's some fun treasures because, yeah, they got pots of gold and they got chests with rubies and what's the blue one? Sapphires. That's just perfect for the Technicolor. But they got this awesome big throne and there's some discussion about the origins of all these. And then my favorite is when it's time for him to play a song, they pull out a Stradivarius violin, which is like a priceless artifact, and he's playing it like an old fiddle. Get some mileage out of that joke.
The dialogue around that is so good because Darby says, because Darby's just like the Leprechaun King is always trying to like weasel his words to a certain end. So is Darby. And so Darby says, oh, well, I need to go home to get my violin if you want to hear me play something, because he's like trying to get out of being trapped in the Leprechaun Mountain. And the king says, oh, well, here, use this violin. It's a Stradivarius. And Darby says, I'd rather have my own. And the Leprechaun says, you'll have to make do with this one.
I don't know if,
like, the best possible violin.
I know. I don't know if you've ever learned about Stradivariuses, but they go for like, so they were, it's all made by one family, the Stradivarius family. And they like to this day haven't revealed the secret for how they make it. And there's like something in the way that they bind the wood and treat the wood that is like a world protected secret. And so because there's only a limited number of them that have ever been made, like world famous violinists will pay like $10 million for one violin, one Stradivarius violin.
Yeah, I love the set design here. And it's so many things working together in combination to sell this illusion that he walks down this hall in the throne room and is surrounded by the leprechauns, like on all sides. So leprechauns to the left of him, leprechauns to the right.
And he does a really, they do a really good job acting. Like you forget that it's, you're looking at forced perspective. Like it really looks like the characters are looking at each other in the way that the camera has designed for them to look at each other and be in spatial relation to each other.
Yeah, I've kind of always just taken it at face value. It's like the effects work well enough most of the time that you can just accept that these are leprechauns.
Oh, and another important part of it is that they made jumbo-sized versions of the props and the sets so that, like, when you would see the King Brian standing next to the throne is actually, like, 30 feet tall, you know?
Right, and they'll even have, like, Darby O'Gill has a coffee mug and it's the size of his hand and he hands it across the frame and King Brian takes it and now it's the size of an enormous bucket.
Right.
But at this party that they have welcoming Darby to the mountain, Darby is able to play a trick. He whips the leprechauns into a frenzy by playing a hunting reel on the violin. And they get so excited that they storm out of the side of the mountain to go on a hunt, and it allows Darby to escape out the crack in the door. And this scene, I can't oversell it. It's like, just go watch this clip. You got to join our Discord where we'll put it in our related media tab. But something that has struck me even more lately is just how many horses they use in this scene. Like, all of a sudden, the leprechauns have miniature horses. And it's like 30 or 40 horses, which are also all subject to the forced perspective stuff. Like, they're not small horses. These were real deal horses that they had. But Darby doesn't make it out with any of the treasure. It like falls through the holes in his pockets like the Polar Express. And so he gets back to his house, but he doesn't have anything to show for it. Until the infuriated King Brian comes after him, saying, "You made me a laughing stock! You can't just trick the King of the Leprechauns!"
Right, because they have, like, a drinking game as part of it. And this is maybe where we could talk about the... I don't know how you actually say it. I spelled, like, poteen or poiteen, but they say it with, like, a ch in there, too.
So, yeah, they say pacheen in the film. And I've only ever seen it outside of this movie once. My cousin had a liquor cabinet specifically for weird liquors, and he had a bottle of absinthe and a bottle of mezcal and a bottle of this stuff.
Oh, nice, yeah. And I was reading a little bit about it, and apparently there's some disagreement, like, on exactly what it means in which context. It's basically shorthand for just moonshine, like strong liquor that someone just distilled. But now, actually, there's, like, a certain... like grain cereal base that is used if you buy something that has that name, like off of at a store or something, you know?
I love that the way that he describes it to King Brian, Darby says, "I found this in the bog."
that's how you know.
That's quality there. You're going to drink the jug you found in the bog. Because I guess leprechauns have magic, but only at night. And they make multiple references in the movie to leprechauns as part of the powers of darkness. Like, how evil are these leprechauns? How closely allied are they with Satan? Hard to say. But yeah, they can do certain things at night. And so Darby has engineered this drinking game to keep King Brian at his side until the sun rises, at which point he'll lose his powers. So they do this drinking game where they have to sing verses of a song while they drink. And this bit always makes me laugh. I mean, King Brian especially is really selling that he's getting drunk. The way that he's like sloshing around.
And yet another reminder to me, we talked about this, I think, just last week, but the stuff you'd have to do to entertain yourself before there was like any sort of electronic entertainment, before you could say, oh, you know what, let's go turn on Shawshank Redemption as we get sloshed together.
Yeah, you can hit a few options. You can sit, you can drink, you can sing. But like this actor, Jimmy O'Day, who plays King Brian, makes some great faces while he's drinking and singing to convey that he's drinking like more than his body weight in this stuff.
Apparently this guy was plucked from obscurity by Disney, who saw him doing like a mime show or something like that.
Wow. And yeah, Albert Sharp, who plays Darby, I guess had been an actor in Ireland, but hadn't really come to Hollywood for anything. So they brought these two old Irish guys over to Hollywood, and they basically did this one movie and then didn't do anything else, at least not at the same level of viewership. Sure enough, the sun rises in the morning, and King Brian has been had. He doesn't have any powers anymore, and like, I noticed this time how many times King Brian hops around. Like, he's got a harness on him or something, so he can make these big jumps. And he, when he came in the nighttime, he flew in through the wall, or like through the door. And then in the morning, he leaps up, tries to go through the door again, and just slams into it. It looks like he hits pretty hard. And just ricochets off, because now he doesn't have magic. Although he can grant wishes, so I guess he's got enough magic, but it's like the imprisoned sort of genie magic.
I liked during this bit where he's like revealing that he's kind of hopping around. Part of the way that that Darby manipulates him is he's got a cat and he threatens to sick the cat on him. And they do some really elaborate stuff with the forced perspective and the cat, where like the cat is like clawing through furniture, but now the leprechaun King Brian is like supposed to be inside that furniture. And honestly, I was many shots I had to pause it. I was like, how is this done? What is happening right here? Because it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's all cool and flows pretty well. Darby calls off the cat and he makes his first wish, which is that King Brian, I don't want you to go anywhere until I've made my other two wishes. You just have to stay here with me so you're not up to any funny business. And he puts King Brian in a sack. And this is the only shot in the movie that I think looks terrible. Because he picks King Brian up in his hand. And you can tell that it's this doll that has like a robotic arm in it flopping around. And so it's like flailing its limbs, but the proportions are all wrong. It looks like twice as tall and like not as wide as it should be. So it's like all stringy and you don't see it very long because he shoves it into the bag. But it's like I think they could have resisted the urge to do that.
Yeah, I noticed that one. That one's a little off, too. But it's like one of the only times that they managed to get them like physically interacting together. So I wonder if they could have found a way to make it a little more realistic, because it's like a weird marionette type thing. Probably animatronic is how they did it.
Right. So now for most of the movie, he's got King Brian in a sack. And he's going around thinking, okay, well, what are my other wishes going to be? Bearing in mind that he's got this young whippersnapper, Sean Connery, here to take his position. But, he thinks about it. So he's got these things on his mind. And he actually goes and takes the bag to show to Michael, Sean Connery. Show him that there's truth to his ramblings, because Sean Connery has been kind of dismissive of his leprechaun stories.
Fancy that.
Dan is coming down hard on the leprechaun stories.
Sorry.
But yes, as one might, I suppose, in a world where one has not witnessed them yet. And so Darby says, look, I like you, man. I am going to show you the leprechaun that I caught. and he brandishes the bag to Sean Connery, but Sean Connery doesn't see the leprechaun. To Michael, King Brian is visible as a rabbit. So the second wish that Darby makes is, I wish you could see him, which isn't even like a serious wish. It's just like a thing that you say. And King Brian says, granted. But Michael couldn't hear that, and he couldn't see him as a leprechaun. The leprechaun says, he sees me, but he sees me as a rabbit. And that pisses Darby off. But they kind of come to a compromise where the leprechaun says, all right, he'll see me in his dreams, which you might think, well, what is that going to do? That's not very useful to Darby. But it's like they convene. Darby and Brian talk, and King Brian's like, okay, I know I kind of cheated you there. What is it that you really want? And they discuss and come to the joint conclusion that getting the daughter together with Sean Connery seems like a good course of action. And if King Brian can help that along, that will kind of be the unofficial second wish.
So I think this is the scene where they're talking about this, that Sean Connery does this little bit of slapstick that might have been the hardest that I laughed in the whole movie. He's like hiding in a bush looking for Darby, and he jumps out of the bush, but it's like a Looney Tunes jump. His like full body extends and he goes horizontal and totally decks Darby. And it made me laugh pretty hard.
One thing that I've wondered about this story ever since the first time is there's discussion of who is poaching the rabbits on the estate. And Sean Connery assumes it's Darby poaching the rabbits. Do you think it's Darby poaching the rabbits?
I didn't formulate a fan theory on this. It certainly seems plausible.
I mean, the other possibility is that it's just like squatters on the land somewhere. We don't really know how big this estate is. I don't know which is better. I mean, both are indicative of him not sticking to the terms of his employment. But he seems to insist that he's not doing the poaching. So I'm not really sure. I'm not sure how to read it. And it kind of affects how you perceive Darby's character.
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, just reading it, is he doesn't actually care about his responsibilities at all. And whether he's just not caring that people around town are taking over the private yard and killing the rabbits and all that, or if he's doing it himself.
And yeah, Darby prefers Michael to the other guy who's competing for Katie's affections, who is this dude, Pony Sugru, in the town. The town bully, kind of the Brom Bones. And I have a complex view of Pony Sugru, I think, because his mother is just horrible. And often she pushes him to do worse things than his own nature would compel him to do. Like, I mean, he's an asshole. Like, he's stealing beer at the bar, and like he threatens the bartender. And when the preacher says, hey, guys, I need somebody to go to the next town over and pick up the bell that their church is donating to our church. And Pony Sugru says, well, I've got a cart, but how much will you pay me? So really, it's like every time that he has the chance to be a good guy, he doesn't take it. But at the same time, like he goes and does his job. He's the mailman of the town. And it's like he seems to be accepted and secure in that role. Just go around, deliver the mail. But the mother is always like haranguing him like, oh, if you would just beat up every other dude in the town, then they would defer to you and you would make more money and you should marry that girl. And he's like, Mom, just let me live my life.
I want to see a retelling of this, but from Pony Sugru's perspective.
You just follow him the whole movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get the inside story. It's like Grendel, the retelling not too long ago with, it was a book.
Oh, right. With Beowulf, but from Grendel's point of view.
Yeah, sympathetic take on the villain.
Yeah, do like a Wicked with Pony Sugru.
One thing I was thinking of is this guy framed as a romantic rival because I'm trying to remember, like, is Janet Monroe's character, did she ever express any interest in him at all? Like, how is he actually a romantic rival?
Yeah, well, he is. He's a lot like Gaston, because does Belle ever give Gaston time of day? It's just kind of like he's perseverant enough and is like head and shoulders above the rest of the contenders that, like, it seems that the town just assumes, oh yeah, they're together.
Interesting. Yeah, it doesn't have like the moral ambiguity of the Brom Bones situation, or at least the maybe moral ambiguity isn't the right word, but
right, it's like we don't have necessarily the full picture of that relationship in Sleepy Hollow, but it definitely seems like she's got something going with Brom before Ichabod is on the scene. Not the case here. Like when Pony Sugru's mom shows up, Katie is not into him at that point. And there's a scene where Katie goes to a dance briefly and she invites Michael along, but he kind of chivalrously says, no, I'm new in town. This is too fast. Can't go to a dance with you tonight. And so she goes off to the dance and she's dancing with some tertiary character named Sean, who is just, you know, didn't exist before this moment and won't exist after the door closes. But, like, Sean is hitting on her. And Pony Sugru, like, wrenches Sean's arm and says, she'll be going home with me, Sean. And takes Katie home on his wagon. So, I don't know. In that moment, at least, she's entertaining his gesture just in a, like, a platonic sense, I guess. Fine, you give me a ride home. That's about the extent of it. But also then I think she kind of uses the fact that he is a presence in her life, that Pony Sugru is this known quantity that's after her, to kind of grease the wheels with Michael. Like, you better step up or the opportunity is going to pass you by. That's my read, at least.
Okay.
Past a certain point, she's using Pony Sugru to, what does Widow Sugru say? Get him to say the hard word. At 20, a lass can have her man marry him up in a minute. But at 30, doesn't she have a time getting him to say the hard word?
You should have done this whole podcast in an Irish accent, Brian.
There are some turns of phrase in this movie that I think of outside of the context of the film, just in my day-to-day life. Like when Darby sees the, I think it's the cannon taken from a ship in the treasure room. He says, oh, that's a fine piece. So if I ever am at like a yard sale and I see like old Nintendo games, I think, oh, that's a fine piece.
Just don't mutter that under your breath if you see a beautiful woman, Brian.
You can't say it out loud. And so what does Brian actually do to get Katie and Michael together? It's like he whispers to them in their dreams that they should go on a date.
Yeah, this is kind of more of the fuzzy, is it all a hallucination, all in the mind of Darby, or is it real? Because they can't see him in real life, but as they're both kind of sleeping and adjusting to this new arrangement, they start to have like, oh, maybe, you know what, maybe I'm feeling drawn to this other person. Maybe we should actually get married. But it also just so happens to be the thing that Darby wants the leprechaun to whisper in the ears of the people as they're sleeping, of his daughter and Sean Connery.
So Darby is ready to think about making his third wish. Things seem to be progressing between Katie and Michael. They have a date and it goes well. And so Darby takes his sack with the leprechaun in it down to the pub. And he makes this grand announcement that he's going to make his third wish. And this, I think, is the scene that for me cements that King Brian is real. Because the bartender gives Darby a drink to give to the leprechaun. And Darby puts it down in the game sack. And the leprechaun drinks the glass. And you can hear the little glug, glug, glug. And then he tosses the glass back. And the whole town witnesses it. Like, a rabbit couldn't do that.
That's true, yeah. And they do acknowledge, like, I can't believe you did that. And they, like, set aside the glass to be, we'll remember this day. But it's still ambiguous. You're right that that detail is kind of hard to reconcile with he's totally imagined. But the fact that, like, he doesn't reveal himself, like, I feel like if you wanted it to the audience to really think that he's real and not have any shred of doubt, this will be the moment that, ta-da, out comes the leprechaun. And everybody's like, wow, Darby, you were right all this time. You're not just a crazy old drunk.
The Mr. Snuffleupagus moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. But everything gets interrupted because Katie has finally found out that Michael isn't just there short term. He's actually there to take Darby's job. And so she has to move out of the house that she's been living in, this groundskeeper's cottage. So she's flustered and angry, and she runs into the pub and yanks Darby out of there again. And he's like, no, this is a big moment. This is my time. I got to make my wish. But it's like the bag gets dropped and King Brian in rabbit guise runs away, which, how is he even able to run away? The wish was you can't leave. So, like, he shouldn't even be able to get out of the sack, I don't think.
That's a good point. And this is another moment for me that made me think maybe this is just the ramblings of an old crazy guy, because a rabbit pops out of the sack and he starts chasing after him saying, come back, your highness, come back, your highness. If I saw a man running after a rabbit shouting that, I would think less of their sanity. That for me was another big laugh in this movie.
I like how at this point Pony Sugru has goons like Biff in Back to the Future, and they start going, yeah, beep, 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 like, cheep, 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 in the room, like, just making fun of him. Anytime that the way that you indicate that you're making fun of someone is by making some animal sound is a little goofy, yeah. Oh, you just chicken, cheep, 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 cheep. So things are up in the air. We don't know how things are going to resolve. And Katie is mad at Michael, and she's running around through the night, and Darby's running around after the leprechaun. At this point, the horse misleads Katie up the mountain again. So is this a horse, or is this a puka, or what exactly is happening? And I've noticed more in recent watches that there is this scene where King Brian warns Darby. He says, you better get me back to my people and stop dragging your feet making wishes. Because if the leprechauns don't know where I am, they're going to essentially unleash black magic on you. Like, I've got a first mate leprechaun who's waiting for me, and if a certain time passes that I'm not there, he knows to let loose the dogs of war, and bad supernatural stuff could start happening. So in short order, Katie, like, falls off the cliff at the top of the magic hill and cracks her head. So she's got, like, some kind of traumatic head injury or something. And this is the cue for the Banshee to show up, who is this spirit that, at least in this movie, comes when you're about to die and screams. What'd you think of this Banshee scene, Dan? Or scenes?
This was another time I was thinking of the Victor Sjöström, or whatever you say his name, the old Swedish director who made The Phantom Carriage, where that was like an old silent movie that used the double exposure to make the carriage seemed like it was a ghost. And we basically have that same concept here, except it's got a little bit more effects applied to it. Like, this carriage comes flying in with the object to take a soul to the afterlife. And it's pretty creepy. Like, all of a sudden we kind of got this dark black magic schema. It's shot at night, or at least made to look like night. And it's kind of spooky itself, the Banshee. What do you think, Brian?
Yeah. This is really scary if you're a little kid. So I think it would have stuck with your children a little more if they'd sat through to the end. But Darby has a couple run-ins with this Banshee. First, when he and Sean Connery are running around the hill looking, where did Katie go? And then they find her crumpled in a heap. And the Banshee kind of creeps up behind them, flying around. And Darby throws a lantern at it, which dispels it for a little while. Then later, they've got Katie comatose in a bed in the house. And Darby hears something at the door. And he goes and he opens the door. And there on the doorstep is the Banshee screaming in his face, which, classic jump scare. The Nostalgia Critic put it at number one on his scariest moment in family films list back in like 2009. But I felt vindicated when he did that. Just that this is a moment that has stuck with a few people.
But I will say, not to dwell on it too much, but if unless I'm mistaken, and at this point I was kind of keenly thinking about it, so I don't think I am. But unless I'm mistaken, I don't think anyone else actually sees the Banshee or any of the black magic stuff. So it kind of reiterates that, or at least it kind of leaves open the possibility that like all of the supernatural shenanigans is just a coping mechanism for Darby.
Yes. You're right. I mean, Darby is generally the only one who sees and interacts with this stuff. But the Banshee beckons to the sky, and this thing that they refer to as the Coach de Bauer comes down from the sky, and it's this like reverse green screened coach and four pulled by horses that it's like a hole in the universe. Like it's green screen, but instead of the background being replaced, it's the people being replaced. So they're just this black hole, and they're driven by a Dullahan, which is this headless coachman guy. So they pull up outside the house to collect ostensibly Katie's soul. But Darby decides what his third wish is going to be, which is to give up his life instead of his daughter's. And King Brian says, okay, you can go in her stead. And so Darby has to get onto the death coach. And I like the production design. I mean, the whole movie, I like the production design, but like this all black stagecoach that he climbs into, and like the exterior is this illusion. And then he climbs into it and it's like a real vehicle. And it takes off. It can fly. So then it's like he's flying over the valley.
And I think it's raining, too.
Yeah, it's spooky. But King Brian appears beside Darby in the flying death coach and lets him know that after this deal was struck, Katie recovered down below. And King Brian says, I wish I could ride with you all the way. And Darby says, I wish you could, too. Which King Brian says is his fourth wish. And remember, three wishes I'll grant you, big wishes and small, but you wish a fourth one and you lose them all. And so I guess the reasoning is that everything is undone. At least that's how it's supposed to work. But like, Darby gets to be alive again. He falls down out of the coach and he's back in the mortal plane. But also Katie is okay. It's not like they went back on that.
Yeah, that this was. So first of all, I thought this was a nice bit of screenwriting, calling it back to the initial fourth wish invalidates the rest. And I actually didn't see it coming until it was just about to happen. I was like, oh, this is a clever payoff on the setup from the beginning of the movie. But I also agree that, hold on a second here. It's like you're just erasing the debt of death here. It's like, I feel like you could constantly manipulate this to be immortal. If you, now that you know this trick, this what the devil hates this one trick. The Banshee hates this one trick. 9 out of 10 Banshees agree.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue maybe that the reason that Katie got hurt was because they were playing with the dark forces. And so if no wishes in the first place, then Abel would have played with the dark forces. So she wouldn't have been in that predicament to begin with. But also, like, would Katie and Michael have gotten together if all the wishes were undone? Hard to say. I think they probably still would have, but I don't know.
it's not like they forget everything. It's like, oh, she didn't fall, because it's, you're not like unwinding all of the things that were a result of that wish. So the ontology of this magic. Now, what do you call it when it's like the explaining the power of the magic? Something about this magic just isn't quite clicking for me, but that's okay. It works in broad strokes.
Right. So now Katie is recovered. Darby's alive again. They're one happy group, except all that remains to do is you got to go down to the pub and beat up Pony Sugru. It's like, that's the last thread that needs to be tied.
Yeah, now that I'm thinking about this, put yourself back in Pony Sugru's perspective. You're kind of like an annoying jerk, sure, whatever. But then all of a sudden, the guy comes in and starts beating you up. I guess he is asking for it, so I'm not going to feel too sorry for him. But I want to see a retelling of this where he's a tragic hero.
Also, Sean Connery sings in this movie. We kind of glossed over that. While he's cutting the turf, he sings this song called Pretty Irish Girl, which I've always liked. And you don't see Sean Connery singing a lot, of course. Missed opportunity, I think, that they never had James Bond sing in any of those ones that he was in.
Oh, man, what if they like just randomly made one of the James Bonds a musical? That would have been great. But I feel like there's a total of like two or three songs in here. It's not just that one. There's like one other song in there, I think.
That's true. There's the drinking song. And then there's also the instrumental pieces where he's like got the one that he learned listening to the leprechauns, which I like when he goes and plays that for the leprechauns. They're like, now play something good. And then that's when he plays the hunting song that gets them all whipped up. So there is some music. But it seems like in a lot of these old live-action Disney movies, they'll have, like, one central song that crops up. Like, in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, there's Whale of a Tale. I feel like there's a couple other movies like that.
So, and then doesn't he sing again at the very end of the movie?
Yes. So while they have just lain Pony Sugru out on the concrete, they ride off in a wagon. And there's a reprise of Pretty Irish Girl.
Okay, so that's a reprise. Okay.
Where it's the two of them singing, Janet Munro and Sean Connery. Because the agreement that they come to, I guess, is that Katie and Michael are going to get married and they're all going to continue living in that groundskeeper's house. I think one shortcoming of this movie is we never see the other house that they're going to have to move to. Like, is it really that different? It's like, what? Now you could have two houses, you know? Darby live in the one house and Michael and Katie live in the other house. That seems like a pretty nice arrangement.
What's going on with this house now? Like, who's using it? Is somebody else getting kicked out? Or is this a new construction?
Man, now I'm imagining that there's just like this whole other half of the town that we don't even see. That Pony Sugru goes over there and delivers the mail every day. And yeah, stories in this village is called Rathcullen. I want to see like Rathcullen B-side.
I like to think that the house they're moving into was actually for Pony Sugru. That's the house he was going to move into. But now he's going to have to live with his mom for another couple of more years.
I do like that actually at the end of the story, they say that he's going to go live somewhere else. Like, there's nothing for him here. He's going to move away.
Oh, does he say that? I forgot.
And I just hope he can get a fresh start in this other town. Pony Sugru, his future is not written yet. There's more out there for Pony Sugru.
I've imagined him going off in the distance with Natasha Bedingfield's The Rest Is Still Unwritten playing in the background.
Maybe he'll go to America, you know? And that's Darby O'Gill and the Little People from 1959. This is the 65th anniversary.
Oh, wow. That's crazy, actually.
Time flies. So what are your thoughts, Dan? Anything to rap about?
I will say I was excited at the prospect of having Sean Connery in this movie, but it's a pretty light role. He doesn't have all that much to do. Like, for as much as we talked about him as being kind of a key figure, his screen time is pretty light. It's like, I feel like a third of this movie is the whole segment where Darby goes down to the world of the little people and has all the shenanigans down there. And so I was a little underwhelmed with the overall Sean Connery presence in this film.
Yeah, that's fair. He really is like the C character. He's behind Darby and King Brian and Katie. But ahead of Pony Sugru. That's about it. I would say, listeners, you should also track down the Gnome-mobile, which was from like 1967. Same director, Robert Stevenson. Same little people effects, except it used a lot more like rear projection and green screen type stuff. And it just looks way more dated, even though it's 10 years later. Almost 10 years.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, I think that's what I would highlight is that this movie just looks terrific. The production values have aged really well because of the techniques that they chose. And even I didn't quite mind the supernaturally like flickering outlines of stuff because I mean, it's reserved for things that are supposed to be really uncanny and like creepy and ethereal. And it doesn't detract too much from the film itself just looking so great. And the forest perspective stuff, it's just fun to watch. And man, like movies, there's a whole thing on film Twitter, which I do not recommend spending much time on film Twitter in general, but about how poorly movies are lit in general these days. And I'm like, well, there's a little more to it than that. But then you watch this, which is just so crisply lit and very thoughtfully designed and just very pleasing to look at, colorful and all that. And you're like, okay, yeah. And this is like, you know, matte paintings and real practical effects and stuff. It looks great. So, yeah.
It does look great. Shall we say whether the movie as a whole is good?
Sure. So Is It Good is our signature section where we each give the movie a rating on our 8-point goodness scale, ranging from very not good, a 1 out of 8, to our masterpiece rating toward a good, which is an 8 out of 8. I will answer first. Is Darby O'Gill and the Little People good? And I'm going to say it's good, Brian. I'm going to give this one a 5 out of 8. It's charming. I just spoke on how nice it is to look at. The cast is fun. It really is, like I said at the beginning, they don't make them like they used to kind of treat. It's kind of slow and slight as a story. I was more engaged with the look and the production than I ever was with the story. And there's funny stuff in it too. It's not unpleasant at all, which is why probably an upper half good, maybe not quite the tippy top of a 5, but like right, you know, mid to upper good, I would say for me. So I think it's worth a watch, and I like how flavored it is with all the Irish stuff. You get the accents, you get the weird drinks, and just this kind of gritty physical flavor to it that carries over. So I enjoyed watching it. Not going to be a film favorite for me, but I had a good time with it. What about you, Brian? Is Darby O'Gill and the Little People good?
Nice. Well, you said film favorite. This one did pop up in my list of 100 favorite films, even as recently as we did our update last year. And there's a lot that I like about this movie. I'm actually going to give it a very high 6, just on the cusp of a 7. I don't know if I quite crossed that barrier. But I think a 6 is the right place. You will note, perhaps, that at my birthday I gave my all-time favorite movie, UHF, a 6. Because I do try to be objective about these things. Maybe it's a little slow. But I like that this is a story where the protagonist is an old guy. And he's still got, like, some flavor to his life. Even if you want to take the tack that it's imagined. Just that he can still find the wonder in the backyard and confront the Leprechaun King. And I like a lot of their dialogue, their barbs that they trade back and forth about how King Brian has never faced such an adversary in 5,000 years. And there's like this guy who's a naysayer at the pub and says, "Don't make deals, don't make challenges against the King of the Leprechauns, Darby, because he's learned a new trick every year of his life." And Darby says, "And I've learned 100 of them." There's just like a gallantry and a panache to the way that Darby faces life, I think.
A charming old guy who's made it through, yeah.
Yeah. And the effects are just so cool. Any time that the leprechauns are on screen, like, you're not going to get the full picture until you watch these leprechauns, these scenes, especially the throne room scene, where he's doing this hunting song and all the leprechauns are galloping around him on their tiny horses. And it's just a feast for the eyes. I like the music. How come James Bond doesn't sing anymore? This is Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Batman doesn't sing anymore. Or no, it's the dance. How come Batman doesn't dance anymore? So that's a quote from The Simpsons when Adam West guest starred, which was kind of a revelation at the time. We're totally off in left field here, because Adam West would later gain a reputation for being game for making fun of his image. But this was like fresh when we were kids of like, holy cow, here's Adam West making fun of himself. And he talks about how Batman doesn't dance anymore, because in the old campy Adam West Batman show, there's one episode where he does a dance. That's
he does the Batusi. Maybe we'll have to watch some 60s Batman at some point.
We haven't really dipped too much into the Batman realm. Actually, we haven't done too much superheroes in general, Brian.
There's just so much Batman, Dan.
Too much.
Who hasn't been Batman at this point?
I feel like at least half of working actors have been either Batman or the Joker at this point. I'm sure Timothée Chalamet is filming something out there right now as some Batman villain.
Yeah. I feel like he's got the haircut for it. I'm picturing him as the Joker, but I'm sure there's a few different characters he could be.
He could definitely be the Riddler. Although now we had Paul Dano as the Riddler. And speaking of Paul Dano, in my Denis Villeneuve binge, he plays a total creepy guy in the movie Prisoners.
Well, how does he compare on the creep scale in that one to Swiss Army Man?
I mean, there he's playing a man accused of being a child abductor. So in Swiss Army Man, he's just kind of like just weird.
Just a cyber stalker.
Not a villain, which I guess in he plays the Riddler pretty well, too, as like a guy that you don't want to be in the same room with, you know.
To bring things back onto the topic of this film, how would you rank Darby O'Gill up against the last Disney original movie Irish film we covered, which was The Luck of the Irish?
I have some fondness for that movie. I enjoyed it, but I just think this is a better made movie. And yeah, it's much more pleasing to watch unless you're like all about the DCOM energy and all of the weird wrinkles of being a Disney Channel original movie made by our boy Paul Hone, who I guess became one of the stalwart directors for Disney a generation later.
A little like Robert Stevenson, you know?
Exactly.
Paul Hone was cranking out Read It and Weep and Luck of the Irish and the Zombies trilogy.
Of which is apparently going to be a fourth.
Zombies 4 is on its way, people. You got to keep listening to the goods for coverage. And on that note, Dan, what is next on our podcast? What will we be doing?
So I think we're going to be doing one of our favorite annual traditions, which is our April Fool's Day episode, where Brian and I each select a quasi-film and almost a film and discuss that. In the past, we've talked about YouTube videos and lots of other little rinky-dink things, old VHS, potty training instructions.
Yeah, pooping tutorials.
Basketball games, exactly. So that'll be fun for us to discuss next week as well, Brian. And I'm actually headed on vacation for the next week. I'm going to Boston. So speaking of Irish, I guess.
Oh, well, have a good trip.
But listeners, I'm excited for that. Brian, thank you for sharing your childhood favorite St. Patrick's Day movie with me.
Anytime.
Do you imagine yourself becoming Darby O'Gill someday?
I think it's in the cards, yeah.
All right. Have a good one, Brian. And listeners, as always, have a good one as well. See you next time.
Bye, everybody. Top of the evening.